Hi, you're listening to People's Radio 107.1 FM. To hear an archive of this and other shows from People's Radio, go to mediacoop.ca/psf-fsp. So I'm here today. My name is Liam Kennedy, and I'm a public historian. I volunteer for the Workers' History Museum, and I'm joined by Ottawa historian and representative of the Workers' History Museum, Ken Clavette. Hi, Ken.
Hello, Liam.
So thanks for joining us today. I invited Ken to share some of Ottawa's lesser-known history of workers and labor struggles that they've engaged in. It's a history that's important to highlight as it helps the social movements that are gathering here in Ottawa for the People's Social Forum. So, Ken, before we start, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Workers' History Museum?
Thanks, Liam. Yeah, the Workers' History Museum is a not-for-profit organization based here in Ottawa. It was founded in 2011 and brought together a group of volunteers who have in some ways or other been trying to do workers' history, and the museum seemed like a way of doing that collectively. It's our goal is to develop and preserve workers' history. Workers' history tends to be rather ephemeral. People, you know, don't keep a lot of written documents, and their history is so important to understanding the region and the Ottawa Valley. And so we hope to collectively interpret, present the history. And as I said, we do this all with volunteers and a few summer students and a few placement students like we had with you a few years ago.
Yeah. I had a little stint doing a little walk tour for you. So when you say workers' history, what do you mean?
Workers' history is examining the social changes surrounding working culture, the roles working people play in society, both at home and at work, in you know, the private sector, public sector, how they function in the economy, the political structures of the community. This includes union and non-union, because unions are just one of the tools that workers tend to use, and of course we want to look at paid and unpaid work as well. So we're looking at what was domestic life like in the home, and what was life like in the workplace, and how did the workers shape the community that we call Ottawa today?
Yeah. I think it's an interesting take on Ottawa as the national capital. We usually think of it as a seat of government and the home of the prime minister, but that really changes when you take a look at the city from a worker's point of view. So what are some economic forces that built the city?
Well, when we go back over thousands of years with the Anishinaabe Algonquin people, this was a major highway and trading route. The Europeans followed on that. But then it was also the building of the Rideau Canal that really got this region going, created by town later Ottawa in 1826. When they started the construction of the canal, but also the workers built the public buildings of a national capital.
Right.
The lumber industry was a major player, and you can still see the remnants here. So those are some of the kind of major focuses that you'll hear in our presentations.
Right. So one of the things you brought up was the Rideau Canal as being a major drive in the development of Ottawa. And we usually think of, you hear the Rideau Canal, you think of a skating rink, or you think of serene photos of the locks. But and it's become a big part of the public image of Ottawa, as much as Parliament Hill has. Can you tell us about its construction and the story of the people who built it?
Yeah, you know, you're right when you say it's one of the major visions people have of Ottawa and the memory they take away. Yet it's a defensive construction project. You know, there was following the War of 1812, the British decided they need a safer route around the St. Lawrence. And so a Royal Engineer, Colonel John By, and less than 200 soldiers ended up coming here. Well, they can't build the Rideau Canal, although they get a lot of credit for it, and not take away from them. They were very good engineers. But you know, from 1826 to 32, the Slackwater Canal system they built, connecting lakes and rivers and flooding swamps, was done by working people, you know. Navvies built 202 kilometers. They built 49 locks and four defensive blockhouses, and I think that is, those navvies are the ones that really built the canal.
So Slackwater means a canal that's built using existing waterways that's just like built onto it.
Yeah, so, you know, in Ottawa, we're spoiled because we think of the canal as being that long stretch, you know, that you talked about with the photographs and stuff. But really, the canal is two rivers and a whole series of lakes. And even lakes like Dow's Lake was actually Dow's Swamp. It only became a lake because they built a dam, which is now, you know, Queen Elizabeth Drive. There used to be a creek that flowed down the Preston, but that was a swamp that's a lake.
Right. Really changed the shape.
And that kept
changing.
Yeah. Those workers changed the shape of the route between Ottawa and Kingston.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned the term navvy. Can you explain a little more about what that is?
Yeah. The navvy is a British expression, quite often now referred to lots of different laborers, but it really draws, it's a shortened form of navigator. Mm. And in the 1700s, there was this great boom in canal building. It was prior to the railroads, and so that's how people move things quickly in England. And so all the workers who labored under it were called navvies as a short form, and that stuck. And so in the British Isles today, frequently a laborer is called a navvy. Mm. The ones in this region, the workforce came from a large part from Northern Ireland, from Ulster. They came affording to be the passage. There was no assisted immigration. They paid currency to get here. They traveled rather light, however, and when they got here, they were exhausted. They were sick and in dire need of work, and so they signed on to very rough construction work on the canal. You know, we estimate there's somewhere between 2,000 craft workers and 5,000 laborers each season. Wow. And it was a seasonal work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they built most of the canal by hand using small tools, pick and shovels. There was very few beasts of burden and very few power. There was one steam pump at Kingston. There was a pump in Bytown that was used a horse, but it was pick and shovel work and wheelbarrows, and they worked 14, 16-hour days, 6 days a week, lived right next to where they worked, and whatever shanties could be built for them. Some of the contractors built, you know, what we think of when they think of the lumber industry, cabooses and stuff, but they were... it was hard work, and they didn't get paid much for it. A skilled worker would get 5 to 7 shillings a day, and a laborer might get 2 to 3 shillings.
Mm.
But they also had to buy everything from the contractors, and they talk about how Philemon Wright from Wrightsville and now Gatineau, he made 1/3 of his profit from his workers. The others came from the British government. So, it was a tough life for them.
Yeah. I guess we'll talk about Philemon Wright a bit later, but yeah, he's a big part of how Ottawa got shaped and a big part of the building of the canal story
as
well.
Again, Colonel Bye gets credit. Well, they were the engineers and sometimes the police force, but it was they gave contracts to people, and Philemon Wright and others, were some primary contractors, but there were, and while they made profits, they at least paid the workers. A lot of the contractors bid low, took the job, and then left in the middle of the night. Work undone, workers unpaid, and those workers would be stranded in the Canadian bush with little to go on. They'd also bid for work that was terribly dangerous. Gunpowder is not invented at this time, so it isn't until 1866 that Alfred Nobel invents dynamite. So the blasting powder they use, it was totally erratic, and some people would lie, or some people would say they had experience, and they would end up killing themselves and their coworkers.
Dangerous work if you're
very
not experienced.
Work, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that this project attracted laborers from to Ottawa from around North America and outside as well, like as you mentioned, Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, there were about 40,000 people immigrating to British North America at the time, and so there was a shortage of worker, and so the wages were down, and conditions were bad. One of the we talked about the dynamite being a terrible killer. The mosquito and forms of malaria actually was the biggest killer, and also had an effect of keeping people off the work. Some camps and work sites, there was a 60% infection rate. So that meant 60% of the workforce could not actually stand to go and work. They did respond, though. I mean, we're at the social forum here, and we're talking about how we respond. And wages were low, conditions were bad, and yet the first year of full construction, 1827, there were three strikes. These were strikes led by French-Canadian bush workers who were clearing the bush, were joined by the different ethnic groups that were working on the canal, protesting against the poor pay and working conditions. And there's no unions at this point in time. These are just collective mobilizing of workers to say, where the conditions we're working in are unacceptable, and we're not going to continue working until things improved.
Right, but these would set the stage for more organization
later down the road. I mean, people always associate strikes with unions, but the strikes existed long before unions. Unions are actually a product of strikes. People figure that after going on strike, we better keep this organizing going.
Right, don't lose this. You mentioned the lumber industry. Would you mind talking a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's hard to distinguish which came first, the lumber industry or capital. And it really was the lumber industry got started with Philemon Wright. You'd mentioned him. He was an American immigrant who set up in 1800 and was looking for a way of raising some cash because this region was quite far away from Montreal and Quebec City and New York. And so in 1806, him and his family decided that they would build the first square timber raft and take it down the Ottawa River to Quebec City and sell it, which would then be taken to England. England was involved in a war with France, the Napoleonic Wars and stuff. And so some of their European timber was cut off from them. So they... Ottawa then became a source, but that first raft, it was quite dangerous taking rafts down rivers, and the first one they got there so late they didn't make much money on it. But it started the industry in the region. It's estimated that about 2,000 people worked in lumber camps by the 1820s. So by the time the Navvies and Colonel By get here, there is a thriving business, and Wright actually is thought to have moved some of his workers, so he would have them in their lumber camps in the winter and then move them into his canal construction work in the summer, so giving them full around work. And of course that industry developed eventually into what we see at the Chaudière, but it was a damn hard life for lumbermen. They lived in small cramped quarters, working again, 12-hour days, and would be away from their families in the bush and only come out in the spring. Then a smaller group of them would take the rafts down the rivers, and the risk of drowning in the rat pits and so on was very high, and lots of people lost their life that way. And of course, if you injured yourself in the bush, you were too far away for a doctor, so you had some co-workers who may have been able to stitch you up if the axe hit your leg, but you could also die of blood poisoning very quickly too.
It's a remote area.
Yeah, here. Very remote. And yet the Parliament buildings, when it got built, that industry built it, and J.R. Booth and other industrialists, they created that industry at the Chaudière that is still there today. Uniform members are making paper and E.B. Eddy's has just closed its plants down, but today there's a tradition that goes back that far in terms of the production, and so it's a workplace. And while people look out from Parliament Hill, powerful politicians, there's constantly been a disgust at the fact that there were all these workers and this industry within sight of a beautiful Parliament Hill. But of course, it was the lifeblood of the city of Ottawa. It produced the economic engine, and yet that didn't mean, again, that workers rolled over. In 1891, there was, again, a surplus of labor. And so all the mill owners decided to reduce wages. There was a very, very bad reaction to the workers, as there always would be, and being forced to work 10, 12 hours a day. So on September 12th, one mill just put down their tools and they walked off and they marched to all the neighboring mills. And so by the end of the day, over 2,400 workers were refusing to go to work. And that lasted 5 weeks, and they were able to negotiate an increase, mostly because some of the workers started going up into the bush to work. There was a shortage of labor, and the mill workers needed, the mill owners needed work, but they got an increase of 50 cents a week, and very shortly thereafter received a 10-hour workday. But it also established, because they didn't have a union again. These were workers who just decided collectively to take action. But they got some support from an organization called the Knights of Labor, which was an early industrial union. And the Knights actually then had a presence at Chaudière and in the mills at the time.
Mm-hmm. And at Chaudière, you can still see a lot of the buildings that were, like, some of the industry is still in operation, but there are also buildings that still stand from that era.
There are buildings. You can still walk through there and be in a building that 100 and some years ago workers were, well, they were making paper there actually till 7-8 years ago. Mm. but it is connected, and hopefully that workplace will also be preserved in their memory. We're working with the developers and the museum to try to make sure that workers' history stays alive when they build the condos there.
Right. Yeah.
Quite often people think of the kind of industry as a male-dominated area, but it wasn't necessarily. Women did wartime work there, but there was a very particular group, Ibieri, one of the early pioneers, got into making matchsticks, and there was a group of women who worked on there called Les Allumettes, being the French word for a match, and they were actually hand dipping matches and making it. And that was an all women workforce. There were fires were very common. The phosphorus they used caused teeth decay and bone decay. It was a rather dangerous workplace. Some people said up to 5 fires a day would break out with the matches long before the safety match was invented. Mm. But these women also organized, and they organized themselves into the first women's only union in North America and went on several strikes. And in 1919, they went on strike over low wages and long hours, then helped to form their union. And they also went on strike to have female supervision. They insisted that they wanted to have women supervising them and not men. That place also has a lot of the struggle of women in the workplace.
I think that's
struggling for their rights.
Right, that's commemorated too by the it's a major road in Gatineau that's named after them.
It's the Boulevard des Allumettes is the first boulevard in Gatineau to be named after a woman who was not a saint or a member of the royal family. And it's actually collectively named after a group of women, which is really...
Oh, that's true, yeah. Now, you mentioned the Parliament buildings, and that's as a theme between sort of two different sides of Ottawa. Can you mention... how the Parliament buildings would be looked at from the point of view of a laborer?
Yeah, that's what we try to do with the museum. So you take a streetscape or a beautiful place like Parliament Hill, and most people think of it as the prime ministers and so on, and government policy. But that was a workplace. That was, when they started building it in 1859, that was a construction site.
Yeah.
It was a deadly construction site. And we talked about how people were drawn to Ottawa for the canal work, where they also did the same thing. They were advertising for workers in the United States, in Ohio,
another huge project.
In England, they were trying to get skilled trades to come over. Of course, when they got the skilled trades to come in, they also brought the tradition of unionizing and collective action from England. Mm-hmm. And so very early on, the workers organized themselves into trade unions. And so Parliament buildings construction actually is probably one of the foundation of the birthplace of the labor movement
right,
in Ottawa.
Catalyst for it, yeah.
The catalyst for it, yeah. They were still in the backwoods. They were... not getting not getting regular work, but the government would not fund it for times, and so they'd be laid off, no social services, no, you know, unemployment insurance. So they collectively had to work together. Massive housing shortages, and they did go on strike and in the first years, and numerous times. They just downed the tools, and one of the wage increases they got 60 to 80 cents a day. So that was their what they were trying to support a family on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was dangerous. They talked about in 1860, a report in a newspaper said that a stone weighing between 400 and 500 pounds was launched into the air. So it was a dangerous place. The museum's been able to identify the first worker who was killed on that worksite, and a worker by the name of Charles Devlin. He fell 45 feet from the scaffold building the West Block and died from his injuries. And yet, the newspaper report said that he had just returned to work having suffered from consumption. So the man was actually working on a scaffolding with TB and probably, passed out or coughed himself off the scaffolding, but that nucleus stayed, and so the first Trades Council in 1872 was from that tradition of the union movement being developed on Parliament Hill. Its council president, Daniel O'Donoghue, was elected the first labor representative to a legislature in Canada, and 1872, and then again in 1874, and this was before Keir Hardie became the first Labour MP in Britain. Yet we don't celebrate that history. So we have to say, little known. We have to say this is important. And so we look at Parliament Hill as a construction site. We're also looking at it as a place where workers turn to protest. You know, they went there in 1835 with the On to Ottawa Trek to protest from the relief camps and demanding real unemployment and looking for rights to unionize and looking for social programs like health care. So we want to say this is what Parliament Hill is, and what the building is. It's a place that can actually pass legislation and policies to benefit workers, and workers struggle there.
It's been an important site for organizing.
So let's take a look, and not look at Laurier and McDonald. Let's look at Charles Devlin, and let's look at the people who came in and the unemployed workers, and what was their story, and what was their contribution to building the nation.
One of the most striking images I recall from working with the museum is the description of the Parliament Building's construction site being like a First World War battlefield, just being the amount of blasting they had to do and the amount of difficulty that presented.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have known, and the First World War was still a generation to come. But when you try to compare it, that's what it was like. It was explosions going off. It took them a little while to organize it so that they actually would send a siren. Otherwise, you'd be working in your place cutting stone, and someone would be blasting and sending 400-pound rocks into the air near you. When you hear those stories, then you understand why we have health and safety legislation.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. So can you elaborate on some other struggles that workers have faced in Ottawa?
Well, we hear about the RAND formula and attacks on it, certainly in the States, and there are some Canadian politicians, some locally, that want to... And that struggle.
I'm sorry, the RAND formula.
The RAND formula is a formula that was developed in 1945 after a strike at the Windsor Ford plant. That's the one that famously the workers used their own cars to blockade the plant and walked away. It turned off the keys, took the keys, and walked away, blocking the plant. But Justice Ian Rand arbitrated the settlement, and he made a ruling that said, where a majority of workers in a workplace support a union, everybody in that workplace has to pay for the responsibility and maintenance of gaining those benefits.
Right.
And so it's become known as the RAND formula, meaning you don't have to join the union, you don't have to go to meetings, but if you get the benefits of the pay and the sick and health care and all the other things in the safe workplace, then you have to pay the administration of the union. It also means the union has to support everybody in the workplace. And that was a trade-off.
Right.
And that has been, since 45, the standard way of civilized dealing in a workplace in Canada. And now we have politicians who want to remove that and want to take us back to the days of 1900 or maybe Parliament Hill, no yeah. safety legislation. Yeah. And so Ottawa had one of the longest strikes in Canadian history at the time, where within blocks of the Parliament buildings, there was a company called the Ottawa Car and Aircraft, and workers had come out of the war suffering, losing families, and they wanted to have a better Canada, and instead they were laid off, and when their union tried to gain benefits, were denied them. So they went on an 18-month strike in 47-48, which was the longest strike in Canadian history at that time, trying to get the RAND formula, and they didn't get it until the company was sold, and a new owner took over, and had already negotiated the RAND formula with the auto workers union. So that history of Unifor goes right back, and that's the story I want to tell. Unifor, CAW, UAW, the CEP, the Canadian Paper Workers Union, the mill workers unions, though that history just continues through time if you just look at the landscape of Ottawa.
It's a big continuity with all of them. So what other obstacles have workers faced in Ottawa?
Well, one of the interesting struggles, and this shows how maybe a community rises up together, and not always necessarily in total solidarity, but the French and Irish have been the historically the main groups that were the underclass or the working class of Ottawa, and some very negative forces in the early part of the 1900s. Took control of the provincial government, Ontario. The Orange Order was an anti-Catholic, anti-French organization, and they actually got the Ontario government to outlaw the teaching of French in schools. And so Ottawa became a focal point with its large working class community and its lower town, and that was all centered around École Guig, a school in lower town, and a couple of teachers, because they went on teaching in French, the Delage sisters, Beatrice and Diane, and the mother guardians were the parents who actually would stand outside of the school with large hat pins, and of course it's a small town, so when any of the inspectors from the province got off the train before they even got their hats back on, word had reached the school that these strangers were in town and they were going to come in and try to close the school down, and they would not let them pass by using the hat. Maybe we need a street in Lower Town called Boulevard Mère Gardiens. They also met with municipal resistance. In January, the police entered the school and tried to prevent the sisters and the teachers from coming in. The community totally mobilized, and they actually lifted the teachers in through the windows, and people opened up and carried them in over the heads of the police, and the police just threw their hands up and said, "This is Toronto's fight, not ours." But the community mobilized. They opened up when they couldn't teach in the public school system. They actually taught in the homes and carried on the traditional of teaching French as a language of education. There was 3,000 students, teachers, and parents marched to City Hall. So they marched across from Lower Town, across where the Cat Canal, and protested at City Hall. At one point in time, there were 3,000 students who were not attending school because the schools were closed. The community support was so strong that they actually went on teaching in Ottawa, and eventually the province dropped their regressive laws in 27. But from 1915 to 27, it was illegal to teach and speak French in schools and so in Ontario. And so we have to know that when we're looking at new immigrants or others coming in, that we have a responsibility to collectively defend our own rights, but the rights of other people as well. So
Yeah, and that's a remarkable side of the story to think of Ottawa in that perspective, caught up in that conflict.
Yeah, I mean, you know, three or four thousand students not in school, you know, is important. It's something we should be talking about. And when we come together collectively here, we have to look at that maybe they didn't get enough support from other working class people. Maybe that was a fight that took place only in the Francophone community. And why was that? Why weren't we doing, you know, the kind of stuff we were trying to do with the session here in the social forum is build solidarity across ethnic and cultural lines, to continue to build worker solidarity and labor solidarity, and to service the bigger social goals that meet all of our needs, you know, to overcome differences of identity or class and gender or language and culture, sexual orientation or abilities. These are the kind of things that we hope with the museum we can expose our successes, but also our failures, and build a better tomorrow through understanding where we were in the past. That we did fight these battles and we had victories, and things like maternity leave and others that we have today didn't come easy. They weren't just someone decided to be generous. These are decisions people had to take to fight, to go on strike, to mobilize, to organize around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's I believe the museum has a display on in the University Center here about maternity leave and the struggle to achieve that.
Yeah, we have a number of traveling exhibits, because that's the other thing we want to be. We want to be the museum that you least expect. So we've produced a film called The Struggle to Remember on the history of maternity leave, which then became parental leave, which is, you know, adoption leave, and maybe it'll come into elder care leave or other special leave programs. How do we get that? So we have a traveling exhibit. We worked with that. We took a community center in the Britannia Lakeside Gardens Community Center in the west end of the city, which was a trolley park, and we actually have an exhibit on a glass wall. So people coming to the community center or the park now learn the history and have a museum experience. And we're going to try to do that with QR codes and in public spaces around the park and other places. And we have some tabletop displays that talk about the different parts. We've done a documentary on one of the first black leaders in the Canadian labor movement, Calvin Best. Cal Best helped found the Public Service Alliance of Canada. We made a documentary and have a traveling exhibit. And through the work we were doing, the Public Service Alliance of Canada Halifax Regional Office named their boardroom after Cal. Years after he's been dead, and he did most of his work in the 60s. And so we're actually bringing his memory back and then inspiring younger people who realize that, you know, this was a man who actually helped bring collective bargaining into the federal public sector, which didn't exist before. And so what other struggles can we take on? What do we need to defend? The stuff that Cal built, and where do we go from here?
Hide in the work that's been done in the past. Mm-hmm. And I guess people can expect to see the Workers' History Museum popping up places they don't expect.
That's
around
our
the
goal.
City.
Yes, we're a museum without walls and without a ceiling, so you never know when you're going to expect us to pop up. And we certainly need more people to help us do that. So we're looking constantly for people to come and volunteer and try to help celebrate the struggle of workers and how that struggle can help build the future struggle.
Great. And so the website is workershistorymuseum.ca. And this is talking to Ken Clavette from the Workers' History Museum. We've talked a little bit about what we can expect in the future about exhibits at Britannia and so on. But do you have anything else you want to mention about the museum?
No, I thank you, Liam, and I thank the Social Forum for not only hosting this radio station, but also for the work it's doing. And the struggle continues. We have a lot to preserve for workers, and we have still much to gain.
Great. Well, this has been an interview with Ken Clavette on People's Radio, 107.1 FM. To hear this show and other shows in the archive, go to mediacoop.ca/psf-fsp.